Okay, the giant British drug company GlaxoSmithKline has a corporate responsibility committee that what it does, it reviews, and here's a quote, external issues that might have the potential for serious impact upon the group's business and reputation. One of their board members is again somebody whose name you might recognise, James Murdoch, who's just been in the news recently. Yeah, you know, there are interests everywhere within the corporate capitalist system. The news media, of course, being big corporate capitalists themselves, have no interest whatsoever in putting out news which is going to generally damage their interests. So those interests might include, you know, the Times, the Sun, the Sunday Times, Sky, perhaps. Murdoch's Australian newspapers recently accepted an undisclosed sum from the drugs industry to produce a series of articles on how wonderful the drugs industry is. Oh, sorry, a series of the articles on independent health policy. So if you want health advice, where do you go? Well, some of us who are a little bit more independent might go to the web, might look up something on Wikipedia. Drugs industry moles on Wikipedia, the information you actually pick up on sites like that, been massaged, that people have been got, we know they're in there, we know they're actually massaging the information so you get the right kind of information for the drug company. Okay, maximising profit. Well, one of the things that's actually happened is that 10 years, or 15, 20 years ago, there were about 50 to 70 new drugs coming onto the market every year. That's now down to 20. The drug companies themselves are, in fact, really not producing the goods anymore in the way that they used to. What they are producing is something called Me Too drugs. This is the term used in the industry. 415 drugs were licensed in US by the FDA between 1998 and 2002. Only 14% were really new. 9% were old drugs, significantly improved, and 77% were Me Too drugs. And they are no better than drugs already on the market. Now, to produce a Me Too drug is pretty expensive, you know, because it has to go through the same trials, but it's not as expensive as a new drug. So what actually happens is that Company A sees that Company B has produced this wonder drug, which is doing very, very well for itself. It's a good market for it. And they say, we want a bit of that. So what they do is they produce something that is almost entirely identical to this. And because it's almost entirely and not entirely identical, they can get a patent on it and they can charge these inflated prices on the patent. So most drugs coming in are just simple reproductions of drugs that are actually available. Now, they might tweak it a little bit. Now, for example, they might make it more convenient to take. You know, kids who, you know, saw some of these kind of gross things to kind of quiet them down in the classroom. Kids on those, you know, it might be inconvenient for them to take in the classroom. So if you have a drug that can be taken morning and evening, it's more convenient. So, you know, they might tweak their drug to do something like that. But on the whole, they're pretty much identical. So vast amounts of money going into producing something which is of no value to humankind because there's a drug out there already. It's a great deal of value to the company because it can make money out of it. There's one notorious case, actually, that I'd like to mention. It was a drug made by AstraZeneca, which is a British company. It was a drug called Prilosec, which was for heartburn. Now, Prilosec was discovered to contain... It was in 2001 when it was coming to the end of its patent. And of course, when it comes to the end of its patent, its price drops dramatically. Now, that's not good for the drug company. They want to keep the price up. So what they do is they looked at Prilosec and they discovered that Prilosec contains two isomers of a single substance. Now, an isomer is if you take a chemical, its isomer is exactly identical to it in every way. It has exactly the same atoms in it, arranged in the same way, but one's a left-handed form and one's a right-handed form. Now, if you assume that, take my hands as kind of being the structure of a molecule, if I turn that one round, it's not the same quite as that one because one is left-handed. You know, this bit goes the other way. And as minute a difference as that is, it can actually create a difference in how they function, how this chemical functions in the body. So what AstraZeneca did, it found that one of these isomers was active and did the job, and the other one just really did nothing. So it took out the inactive one and rebranded the active one as Nexium, absolutely identical to the old one in terms of its active ingredient. But because it was different, it sought a new patent for it. Now, it gets better. It gets better. In order to seek a new patient, it had to test it. And it tested it against Prilosec, and it did better than Prilosec. And we now know because they massaged the figures. So they tested it against their own identical drug, massaged the figures, it came out better, got their patent, bumped up its price, 3.5-4 times the price of Prilosec. So again, is this of value to us? I don't think so. There's other ways that they can do it. They can reassign old drugs. When Prozac came out of patent, it dropped to 20% of its previous cost. What they did is that they dyed it a pretty pink and lavender colour. They called it Sarafem, and they marketed it to women for premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Kind of bad periods to you and me. Yeah? Okay. And of course, it was a new drug. So whereas Prozac is now selling at its non-patent cost 20% down, Sarafem, absolutely identical, absolutely same dose, is now selling 4-5 times the price. And that happens. Now, what actually often happens is that the drug industry is heavily into using its drugs off-label. And what this means is that it gets them licensed for one purpose and for one target patient group, but it actually markets them for another. In America, it can market them directly to the public. Or it can, in this country, it's not so easy, but what it does, it actually encourages doctors to be very loose in their prescribing. It puts out information for them, which makes them believe that they, for example, very often, it's a drug actually that's been licensed for adults, is actually then used on children, which it's not licensed for because it's not been tested on them. That's a very common process as well. Anyone remember thalidomide? Yeah, you can't really forget that. I mean, if you're a certain age, anyway. No, that was a terrible drug. What happened to it? It's still out there. It was rebranded. It was rebranded as Thalamid as a treatment for some of the side effects of leprosy. Now, that's why we don't see it in this country, because leprosy is not very common here. But in Brazil and in South America, it's very common. So Thalamid is still being used on women. And as the World Health Organization points out, you cannot devise a protocol which can absolutely make sure that women are not pregnant when they receive this drug. So thalidomide children still actually being born back in Brazil, despite the fact that alternatives, are safe alternatives, are available. I'm going to skip some of this because I think we're... I just want to say a little bit about developing drugs overseas. Now, you might have seen back in November last year, the Independent ran a whole series of articles on drug use, drug testing. I think I said earlier that it was becoming more and more expensive here. So they thought, well, why don't we go out to the third world? Because we've got people out there who can't get medical treatment, who would just be willing to come in for a drug test. And of course, actually, what we can do is we can use cheaper equipment, maybe more painful, much more painful if it involves the surgical elements. It might be much less pleasant for them, but we can use it out there because they're not going to complain. And we can get it done cheaper. And that's what they've done. And they've been doing this for quite some years. And the Independent caught on to it. As I say, it's very rare that things get into the press like this because of the kind of connections. But the Independents did pick up on this. And they were testing on victims of Bhopal as well. And they were finding people who, because they didn't actually understand what they were being letting themselves in for, did not actually enter into these drug tests with full consent. Some of them were actually sent by tribal elders in India from the tribal groups. They had no idea. It was a complete scandal. Again, I won't go into the details there. I mean, some of them are quite gruesome. What was very interesting is that after the very first article appeared in The Independent, the same day, the ABPI, which is the British equivalent of the American FDA, which is responsible for... It's basically a kind of commercial group who look after the interests of the pharmaceutical industry. They produced a reply. It goes like this, the first part of it. I was saddened today to read a report in The Independent that accused our industry of exploiting loose regulations for clinical trials in India. This is fundamentally untrue. Pharmaceutical industry is rightly highly regarded. Through global harmonisation via the International Conference on Harmonisation process, clinical trial standards are international. Our industry is careful to meet these standards. Patient safety is always our priority. And beyond that, if pharmaceutical companies are to be successful businesses, then they must work within the regulations. Let me just point out these really weaselly words, because let me just point out to you that in the last 5 years, the pharmaceutical industry has paid out $14.8 billion in fines and penalties for breaking the regulations. So, weaselly words, you know, it's like, you know, we, you know, there are regulations, they don't allow us to do this. Well, we know what they think of regulations. And the fact is that because this is a capitalist industry within the context of a capitalist system, they have to do that. Everything comes down to the cost-benefit analysis. The government introduces legislation on behalf of capitalism as a whole. The drug industry says, okay, what's the chance of our getting caught? And how much are we likely to lose if we do get caught? How much are we likely to make whether we get caught or not? And it's a cost-benefit analysis. Everything is a cost-benefit analysis, down to whether we break the law or not. That's the way the system works. That's the way the system forces these organisations to work, because they are in competition with one another. As soon as one starts doing it, they all have to do it to keep up. Because if they don't, one is going to make more money than the other. As soon as it starts to make more money, that's the company that's going to attract the inflow of capital so that it can expand and potentially put its rivals out of business. The system constantly forces this on us. So it's criminal actions all round. And again, I'm going to miss out. One thing, I can't miss this out. One of the factors is all these actions that have been taken against the pharmaceutical industries have been the result of whistleblowers within the pharmaceutical industries themselves. They have been hounded. They have really been hassled and terrified, some of them, once they have done that. But it's all been done by whistleblowers. It's not been done by the regulatory bodies that are supposed to oversee that. Why not? Because the majority of people on the regulatory bodies function as they're paid consultants of the pharmaceutical industry. On the FDA in America, for example, most of the members are consultants of drug companies, and there were six such experts on the advisory committee that approved Vioxx in 1999. Vioxx is a drug that has produced about 60,000 deaths and was very poorly researched. Not just the Americans, the European Medicine Agency is currently under investigation for fraud. It's a drug licensing agency just like them. And the investigation into the agency's role into the regulation of a diabetes drug called Mediator. It was found to be responsible for 2,000 deaths and finally withdrawn in 2009. The agency gets 80% of its funding from pharmaceutical companies. Okay. This has really gone on longer than I'd actually planned. I have about another 10 minutes on the tobacco industry. Do you want to hear it, or do you want me to wind up then? No.
Yeah, I'm not too, but I don't know if everyone else.
Yeah?
10 minutes, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah?
Is that okay?
Sure.
With everyone?
Okay.
Is that right?
Really? Yeah. Yeah. I don't want people going to sleep on. All right.
And if I smoke while you're doing
it? I will leave that for the room to decide.
No, Richard. Okay.
As long as you don't make me sick.
Outside.
Okay. Now, the drug industry has seen a large number of mergers in the last 10, 15 years. So very big, powerful businesses. And that's even more so of the tobacco industry, especially since 1999. There are now five mega corporations worldwide. There's Philip Morris, and you probably all know it, British American Tobacco, Japan Tobacco, Imperial Tobacco, and Altria, which was originally the parent company of Philip Morris, which hived off from it. It's a huge global industry, okay? And we know that tobacco is implicated in many life-threatening diseases. In 1905, 1906, the latest statistics I could find, 1.7 million people died of smoking-related illnesses in the UK. However, there has been strong evidence against tobacco since 1930, as early as 1930, linking cigarettes particularly to cancer. Of course, that evidence was a threat to the tobacco companies, and of course, they reacted in accordance with capitalist rationality. As we now know, they paid scientists to cast doubt on the evidence. They hired expensive lawyers in the US in particular, wherever litigation reared its head. And for years, these lawyers managed to persuade judges to rule epidemiological evidence out of court. Simply that, you know, if you have an individual, just because in general there is a, you know, it's a threat to health, you can't prove that it's this person, you know, it actually caused this person's cancer. Therefore, they ruled it out of court. US handed out millions of dollars, the tobacco companies handed out millions of dollars to politicians to fight their cause. And of course, we have our own dear politician who is quite notable in his promotion of the tobacco industry in the UK. Anyone know?
Ken Clark.
Ken Clark, absolutely. Ken Clark, MP, senior cabinet minister under the Thatcher government and the Major government. He, over 10 years, he was paid over £1 million by BAT, British American Tobacco, and loads of perks. You should see the history of the perks that he actually, it's really quite funny. You know, so he's really into kind of Formula One racing. He was wined and dined wonderfully. He's on record as promising the chairman of BAT to curb excessive costs and regulation of the industry. And we know that he campaigned to remove the smoking kills messages on cigarette packets. He's manipulated, among with other people, the media to confuse, misinform and seduce. Historically, the tobacco industry have focused their advertising on children. I've got here a quote from one US tobacco salesman. They got lips, we want them. And in 1954, there was a remarkable document. I'm not going to read it out, but I've got a copy of it here if anyone wants to see it afterwards. It was called A Frank Statement to Cigarette Smokers, which was published in the New York Times and 400 other newspapers, local newspapers, which just basically says, okay, well, we've seen this research, but it's not proven. People, you know, they're not really entirely... not everyone agrees, not all scientists agree, and we would be the first to stand up to, you know, some and take seriously any real evidence that showed that tobacco was harmful to health. Great piece of publicity. Robert Proctor, who is quite a notable historian of science, I've got a quote from him. It represented the beginning of one of the longest campaigns of deliberate distortion, distraction, and deception the world has ever known. And by the way, this campaign of distortion, distraction, and deception is all on record, and it is now currently being carefully studied by the fast food industry. So beware. From 1954 to 1996, in 42 years and 300 lawsuits, the tobacco industry never paid a cent. They got their lawyers to get around every single lawsuit that was actually brought against them. And their tactics, one of the lawyers for the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, which was a smaller tobacco company in America, said, the way we won these cases is not by spending all of Reynolds' money, but by making the other son of a bitch spend all of his, you know? Okay? It's got an awful lot to do with the facts of the case, of course. Since 1996, they've won only 59% of their cases, but they have now been sued successfully by many US states. Part of a settlement, which was brought by 46 American states, was not to target youths in the advertising, promotion, or marketing of tobacco products. But it still continues, and the lawsuits continue, because it is still profitable for the tobacco industries to break the law and pay the fines. It's basically simple logic, the capitalist rationality. In 2005, US companies spent $12.7 billion on marketing. In 2006, there was a court decision, and I think this is really quite interesting. There was a Jessica Kessler, judge, US federal court judge, said, over the course of 50 years, this is in her summing up, over the course of 50 years, defendants, that's the cigarette company, lied, misrepresented, and deceived the American public, including smokers and the young people they avidly sought as replacement smokers, about the devastating health effects of smoking and environmental tobacco smoke. They suppressed research, they destroyed documents, they manipulated the use of nicotine so as to increase and perpetuate addiction, and they abuse the legal system in order to achieve their goal, to make money with little, if any, regard for individual illness or suffering, soaring healthcare costs, or the integrity of the legal system. The judge is quite right, but her moral condemnation is misplaced, because the tobacco companies were behaving entirely in accordance with capitalist rationality. They were behaving in accordance with the system. The same law that made this decision makes it illegal for any company, including a tobacco company, to behave in any way except that which will maximise the profits of their shareholders. So there's the contradiction and the waste in all this kind of all legal expenses and everything, the total waste that actually goes on. But of course, the capitalist system is very worried about tobacco, because although the individual profits of the tobacco companies are important to the GDP, the overall effect on the capitalist class as a whole is damaging, because there is an awful lot of taxation. Again, remember that today we actually educate young workers to quite a high degree in order to survive in the highly technological business world which they are employed in. That costs a lot of money. So if a young worker dies at 40 or 50, when they could work on to 65, there is a loss of income. There is a loss of investment. So that is a concern. The health costs of looking after these diseases, some of which, like emphysema, some of which are really terrible, of smoking, are also a burden upon the taxation, which comes primarily, or in fact fundamentally, from the capitalist class. So they are concerned. So that they are constantly having to deal with this contradiction within the system which provides them with their profits. I think the NHS spent something like 1.5 billion in 2005-2006, or they said at the time, on smoking-related health costs, although they think it's actually closer to 5 billion a year now. And that doesn't include the loss of investment in the workers. It doesn't include costs of when the breadwinner dies from Social Security. It doesn't include the costs of what happens when mothers, fathers are left with children and so can't work. So there's a strong incentive for the state to act. So we banned smoking in public places. Advertising and marketing is now heavily curtailed. We put warning on packets and it's heavily taxed. But we don't actually withdraw. The government doesn't actually withdraw it. Nevertheless, British-based companies add significantly to GDP in manufacturing and exports. In the US, some constraints have been placed upon advertising, and flavoured tobacco products, which were meant to appeal to children, have actually been banned. Nevertheless, they're still out there, and there's court cases are still coming in. See, because tobacco, which has grown a lot in the United States, contributes to quite a few sectors of the economy, to the agricultural sector, fiscal, manufacturing, exports. So the subsidies on tobacco growing in America were only cut in 2004. That's really interesting, because they were only cut when the tobacco companies were making such an enormous profit that it hardly actually made much difference. And you need to compare that with the fact that the government in America does not subsidize the growing of fruit and vegetables. Only tobacco, or it did. So the US and UK markets are in decline as a result of this new legislation, so they're turning their attention overseas to the developing world, like pharmaceutical companies. It's a huge receptive market. Their marketing techniques are to aim at youngsters as ever, giving images of virility or femininity and excitement. And this statistic really shocked me when I came across it a few years ago. It really took me aback. It's estimated that the marketing of Western cigarettes from tobacco companies results in 80,000 to 100,000 new smokers per day in what used to be called the third world, in the developing world. In the 21st century, 1 billion people are estimated to die of smoking-related diseases. What if you apply a human rationality to that? I won't go there, I'll just leave it as a question hanging over you for you to think about. In the US and the UK, there's been moral condemnation by governments, but no additional constraints on exports have been forthcoming. because it boosts the GDP and there's no costs at home. The cost-benefit analysis does not affect the capitalism within the UK. So it's not considered. Just one sidelight before I start to wind down on this. There's one rather interesting feature of the tobacco industry, and that is smuggling. There are two British companies, Imperial Tobacco and Gallagher, which are exporting billions of British brand cigarettes abroad to countries that don't smoke them. Billions are going abroad. And particularly, they're going to Cyprus, they're going to Andorra, and they're going to South Africa, where they are smuggled back into the UK. As many as one third of cigarettes smoked in the UK are illegal, have been smuggled back illegally. The government, of course, is very concerned with this because it leads to a loss of 2.5 billion in tax revenue, 2.5 billion pounds each year. There are no legal controls. The Imperial Tobacco spokesman, Paul Sadler, here's a lovely quote from him. "What we are doing is legal, but the law is being broken at some point. We have thought long and hard about smuggling, and we don't believe there is any more we can do about it. Except, of course, collect the profits." As far as Imperial is concerned, this is simply capitalist rationality at work. So the capitalist system is really designed to damage your health. And I've given you an overview. Well, when I started this, I can tell you the amount of evidence that I actually was able to put together on this theme, on health. I mean, I've only just looked at the pharmaceutical and tobacco industry. You know, think about environmental health. It's extraordinary, the amount of evidence that you can actually find out there. And you can apply it not just to health, but family welfare, everything. Every single aspect, intimate aspect of our lives is damaged by the same kind of logic which capitalism requires to survive. I think that's really all I really want to say. I have one final quote, but I'm not going to give it to you unless you are really, really eager, because it is a real stunner. So if you want to ask me for it afterwards, I will put it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Richard.